I was in Donetsk, in rebel-occupied Donetsk, in July. There are very serious human rights issues there, but the humanitarian situation there is also catastrophic. You have a lot of people who have been displaced. You have a lot of people who are going hungry, who don't have access to clean water, to medicine. You have allegations of enforced disappearances, arbitrary detention, torture. The West needs to support Ukraine, but it also needs to hold it to account for its human rights violations, because it also has not done everything it can. And sometimes there are some military groupings which are also involved in or implicated in human rights violations.
We're going to have to leave it there, but of course we'll continue to follow all of these issues. Niels Muižnieks is the Council of Europe Commissioner for Human Rights. And that does it for our show, though this news just in, Democratic presidential candidate Lincoln Chafee has dropped out of the race for the Democratic Party nomination for president. Chafee's a Republican turned independent turned Democratic former governor and senator of Rhode Island. We have a job opening at Democracy Now! It's development director full-time in New York. Go to our website to find out the details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, and Pedro Rodriguez. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. I'm fine. Huh? Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. Today is October 23rd, 2015. Getting ready for Halloween out there, folks. Scary time. Careful of the little ones crossing the streets. Back and forth, practicing for the big day, even. That's possible. Anyway, glad to have you with us today. This is, of course, the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. And we have with us today as a special guest to start off one of our favorite counselors. They're all our favorite, of course, over in the counseling department. Diane Green is with us to talk about the non-traditional careers for women in technology. Special workshop that's coming up, and we do talk about these every year. There's usually in one semester it's for non-traditional careers for women, and then the next semester non-traditional careers for men. Things that you might not ordinarily think about in terms of maybe a job change or your first job, even just because you know, the word is not out that there's opportunities for people of both sexes equally. Genders. I have to say genders because.
Genders.
Oh, okay. We'll get into that. Okay, Diane. Diane's our expert on careers. On these particular workshops that are offered, which are always very, I assume, eye-opening to the attendants, and that's the whole point of it. First of all, let's give the date. It's next Wednesday, October 28th.
That's right.
Starts early in the morning, 7:30, and can continue with. Discussions till 2 p.m. and it's completely free right here on the main campus. Well, I've got to stop saying that. There's only one campus. Well, there's the MTech campus, but
right.
Okay.
And the nursing. They kind of refer to the nursing campus as the East.
That's
campus.
Right next to MTech. So
yeah.
East campus. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, things keep changing here.
Right.
We got to keep up. Okay. So this program though is free and includes a complimentary continental breakfast. Tell us about the content. This one is focusing on non-traditional careers for women in technology. So what sort of careers are we talking about there?
Well, we tend to draw our focus on high demand, high pay programs that produce graduates into areas that are high demand, high pay. So we're focusing on our energy tech program, and we have a variety of different programs there, ranging from alternative energy to heating and cooling and boilers and any number of areas that women can begin to look at as non-traditional areas of study. Criminal justice, we're seeing more and more women going into law enforcement, probation, parole. A lot of that has to do with the roles that women are playing on police shows.
Sure, I was going to say
that
popular.
We're seeing. Oh, absolutely.
Television culture.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and we're seeing lots and lots of young women expressing an interest there. Machine tool technology, we're not seeing the influx that we would like to see from women going into manufacturing areas. But I'm hopeful that as the economy has really started to pump up, we're giving more energy as a country to manufacturing. Hopefully, we're going to see more women begin to express an interest in that area.
Which these days, it would be more working with robotic systems.
That's right, machines.
It's not like the olden days where you work on the assembly line and you have a machine that literally you're keep punching the switch,
right,
or the
it's
buttons.
It's all
or,
programmed.
Yeah, right.
It's all programmed.
So it's not that same sort of hard, sweaty labor that it was 30, 40 years ago.
And that's what we're hoping that women are going to begin to look at and say, wow, mm-hmm. this is very attractive, mm-hmm. and very interesting. We're doing hospitality. And for our listening audience, we do now have a bachelor's degree in hospitality. So hopefully we're going to see our numbers increase even more with young women coming in looking at hospitality management or culinary arts.
And how has that program changed? I know we had a lot of great classes here, and we have a few more classes to complete their junior and senior year, but there are probably some internships or cooperative experience too that they're.
But those were automatically built into
in the first place.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So what they ended up doing was just rolling that out and filling in a lot of the liberal arts kinds of requirements that would push them then to the 120 hours that's needed for that baccalaureate degree.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was some pumping up of the hospitality courses, but much of that was already in place. So we didn't have to do a lot there.
People normally think of, in terms of hospitality or restaurants, there's a lot of women in that area. Waitresses,
mm-hmm.
but that's not necessarily a very lucrative lifetime career, unfortunately.
When you look at where we're giving the focus, and that's women as chefs, mm. and that's where you're not seeing women filling out those particular roles in that work setting. We're starting to see that change.
All the food prep shows.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the competition among the high-level chefs and so on.
Right. And the fact that they're now doing these shows that are competitions, and you're seeing more women entering these competitions. They're judged by chefs, and mm-hmm. they're picking the best competitor to move forward as a chef. And every now and then I look at them, and I'm seeing more and more women coming in, mm-hmm. participating in that. So that interest is growing. And I think women are beginning to see, well, wow, that's actually an extension of what I do anyhow. I enjoy it. I'm really good at it. Maybe I should think about pursuing that.
Yeah, in a way, it's been sort of stereotypical. The woman stays at home and does the home type stuff, including making the food. Well, that's been a stereotype for 100 years, a couple hundred years,
that's
maybe
right.
forever. I don't know. Except when women ruled the world briefly a couple millennia ago. But seriously, but to do it outside the home mm-hmm. is something that hadn't been visualized, I think. And again, here, popular culture and some of these TV shows showing women competing as mm-hmm. chefs, even, mm-hmm. and winning contests against men. I think that helped. And, of course, we should mention management of hospitality programs, hotels and
restaurants.
And restaurants, that could be part of it, too.
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. even that kind of training oftentimes will extend itself into tourism and travel. Mm-hmm. If the individual wants to kind of branch off and expand into those areas as well.
What else?
We've got architecture, construction, tech, and we're so excited that they're finally here on the main campus, because for the first 7 to 8 years that we were doing this, attendees didn't have an opportunity to see their labs. And I can remember last year, there were several women that walked in the lab and on the spot decided, I want to do architecture, construction, technology. We're seeing more and more women moving into that area. Our computer information systems, we highlight the information assurance program, which is the security piece of computers. And there are very, very few women even here at the college that are in that area of concentration, as well as computers overall. And then our industrial drafting CAD is a great opportunity for women. It allows them to capitalize on their creative side and take those skills and morph them into a technical kind of program of study.
I assume everyone knows by now in this day and age that a CAD is not a bad person. It's computer-assisted design, folks.
Yes, yes. And our program really has a very strong, robust CAD component. They actually have three CAD courses. There are two that are required, and then there's the third one that they can pick up. Institutions like the University of Michigan Ann Arbor, with their architecture program, does not have that deep concentration on CAD. We were actually able to develop a transfer agreement with the University of Michigan Ann Arbor's architecture program for our CAD courses, and as a result, even a few of our architecture courses. So our program does an amazing job with the CAD. And Weeks always says, you know, industry's wanting to pull my students out after they've had two CAD classes. I want them to finish the program. So there are jobs. So that's the other thing that we want the attendees to be aware of, is that there are employment opportunities, good paying employment opportunities upon completing these programs.
And in fairly high demand too.
Yes.
Of course. Yeah. And they'll be hearing, as in all the times that you've done these workshops, for 8 years, in fact, so 15 or 16
actually,
already.
Nine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's an eighth annual. Shame on them. And it's not only the heads of the programs who should know something about the program, but also in many cases, there's some students who are enrolled in these programs that you were able to get to come in. And so, you know, potential students can actually hear about the program from students who have been in it or have already completed it. And that's always an extra great component. So we're talking, folks, about the special workshop here, Non-Traditional Careers for Women in Technology, here at Henry Ford College Evergreen Campus. And that will be next Wednesday, October 28th, from 7:30 in the morning to 2 p.m. It is free, but you probably do, just so you have enough complimentary breakfast.
And a free lunch. And door prizes. We have fabulous door prizes this year.
Yeah, you should call, folks, 313 if you're interested in this. And this is, I should say, not just for current students at Henry Ford College, but anyone from the general public who's interested in joining.
And high school students have started participating as well. Mm-hmm. This is designed for individuals who are undecided about a career direction, or want more information on an area that they have an interest in.
Exactly. And so that number is 313-845-9629. That's Cynthia Anderson. We're speaking with Diane Green. You could ask for her in the counseling department if you want to, but
yes.
Cynthia is the one taking notes on the registries. Registered people.
Yes.
Cynthia Anderson at 313-845-9629, or email at crandersonfour@hscc.edu.
They can also call 313 313- 845-9617. Okay. And that's Brenda Redinger's number, who is also assisting with reservations.
So again, there's a lot of numbers to choose from there. 845-9617 is Brenda. Cynthia's at 845-9629 for the Non-Traditional Careers Seminar for Women.
And one other thing, you can be a walk-in. If you decide at the last minute, I think I want to do this, come on over and join us.
So let's tell them where to walk. 7:30 in the morning next Wednesday, but on our Evergreen main campus of Henry Ford College. It's in the Patterson Technical Building, and they've, in the last year, they put up big letters to, they've given a single big letter to each building, and the Patterson Tech Building, which used to be just called the T Building for, like, technical, it's now the E Building for, I guess, excellent programs. I know.
Enterprises.
Okay. And the electrical people are there, too. I know. But
they are.
They're probably happy about the E, I'm sure. And so just come on by. It's called the Ghaffari Conference Room. It's easy to remember, 123. And it may also have the T in front of it still if they haven't changed the sign on the door.
Right.
But
and they'll see us in the hallway because the registration tables will be
so
there.
The Patterson Technical Building, Building E, main campus, Henry Ford College, next Wednesday morning. Non-traditional careers for women in technology. All of the best seven or eight areas that have high pay potential and high demand, too, at this point that maybe if people haven't been paying attention to popular culture or they haven't been keeping up with all the changes in the career areas that are happening in the last couple of years, it'd really be valuable to them. It could, as they say, life-changing.
Yes. So,
well, thank you for coming by the Journal today, Diane, and all the great work that you and all the counselors do at Henry Ford College here to get the message out about new opportunities and to straighten out maybe enrollment problems. The final kick, though, we have to give to the fact that winter semester is not far away. It's getting chilly outside.
Make those appointments and get on in here.
If the leaves are changing colors, it's time to go and enroll in the winter semester at Henry Ford College, beginning in January, and, of course, ending in the very first couple days in May each year. First come, first served, with the best choices for times and days and so on. And the actual computer registration system will open up next Monday, October 26th. And, of course, if you need any questions answered, the counseling department is there, too.
Please do not hesitate to come on in.
And your offices are also in the Welcome Center, right?
That's the advisors are in the Welcome Center.
Oh, the advisors.
Yeah.
Okay.
The counselors are in the counseling office.
Which is in which building?
And that's in the A Building.
Uh-oh. Well, we have this wonderful Welcome Center for new students who are enrolling in programs for credit. Now, you don't have to be enrolled in a program for credit to get into the Non-Traditional Career Seminar for Women. They can tell you all about how to do that, but certainly, if you're already enrolled here at the college, winter semester, it opens up next Monday, October 26th, and, make your choices, look at the schedule, the times, and sign up as soon as you possibly can. And if you need to, the counselors are in the A Building.
Yes.
Because it should be the first one you think of.
Yes. And new students should be applying now. You actually should have applied. Should have applied for your financial aid. You need to come in and take your Compass placement test. So you need to get all those things done so that you, too, can enroll, register for your classes as early as possible.
Yeah, it used to be, in the last millennia when I was growing up, that the community colleges, you might apply to them, you might get accepted, but they're sort of like the backup plan if you don't get into a four-year school, at least for some of us who were valedictorians, that was the case. Because they felt, you can always get into classes at the last minute at a community college. Yeah, but you won't get placed at the right levels until you get through this program. You won't get the financial aid that you probably deserve in one way or the other if you don't have enough lead time.
And you may not get the classes on the days and the times you need them or want them. So the early bird catches the worm. That's what I say to students.
And, of course, a lot of these questions and these programs, including, I assume, the Non-Traditional Career Seminar for Women, that information and the stories are on our website, hfcc.edu.
Right.
They can find out more there. So thank you, Diane Green, being with us on the new WHFR Journal, Non-Traditional Careers for Women in Technology. We need more female geeks. That's what
That's
I think.
Right.
Okay.
And thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure being here, Jay.
Well, it fits our format, even on the
yes.
journal. We try to do things and to explore possibilities for people that they don't get from other sources. And college is always about that anyway, I think. I mean,
it
we
is.
Try to keep the minds
it
open
is.
And the ideas flowing. And hope you can be with us in the future if you're not already on campus now. And the Non-Traditional Careers Seminar next week for women in tech is a great way to do it. We're going to start with a late-breaking commentary, actually, from Jack Lessenberry from Michigan Public Radio. Yes, there's a plan, you might have heard about it on other media, to fix the roads in Michigan.
Yay.
But Jack has some problems about that. So let's listen to Jack Lessenberry about how not to fix the roads in Michigan, and we'll talk about that with you and other top stories in the Dearborn area in just a few moments. So listen up.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. The good news is that the Michigan House of Representatives passed a package of road funding bills last night. Unfortunately, that's also the bad news. The truth about this plan was best stated by Business Leaders for Michigan, whose members aren't exactly left-wing socialists. "We believe this is unsustainable and fiscally irresponsible," their statement said. That's primarily because the plan would cut $600 million out of the cash-strapped general fund without specifying where those cuts would come from. Everyone knows, however, that this would hurt the neediest Michiganders and damage the state's ability to compete and prepare its citizens. Moments after the House passed these bills, I heard from Tom Watkins, the CEO of the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority. "Watch the pea under the shell," he told me. "Where is the $600 million in undisclosed cuts coming from? Schools? Persons with disabilities?" Watkins knows both are bound to be affected. He's a Democrat, but most members of the Business Leaders for Michigan are not. They noted that the state's general fund hasn't grown in real terms in two decades. They said, "Redirecting $600 million to roads means fewer dollars would be available to make college more affordable, train Michigan workers, and spur job creation. In fact, this plan, which is rammed through with virtually no Democratic support, is even worse than it first seems. The minimum needed to fix the roads is $1.2 billion a year, a figure the Michigan Department of Transportation says isn't nearly enough. This bozo of a plan wouldn't generate even that much until 2021. What it would do right away, however, is give rich people a tax cut they don't need and which the state can't afford. Voters this spring overwhelmingly rejected Proposal 1, the constitutional amendment that would have raised the sales tax to fix the roads. Everyone said a major part of the reason they turned it down was because the plan was like a Christmas tree with all sorts of non-road-related stuff in it to try and win votes. Well, the bill passed last night was the same, except worse. State Representative Jim Townsend of Royal Oak may have put it best. He told the Detroit Free Press, "The income tax rollback, apparently the price necessary to push this dreadful package through, is the ugly conclusion to what term limits have brought us." He said, "It would be a fiscal time bomb, and I don't think anyone is aware of how explosive this is likely to be." The good news, if there is any, is that this plan in its present form is not going to fly in the Senate. Indeed, there's some indication that this was meant as an in-your-face from Speaker of the House Kevin Cotter to Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff. The Senate isn't going to pass this plan, but they might use it as a framework for something almost as bad. What's worrisome is that Governor Rick Snyder has not said he'd veto the House bill. Not long ago, he indicated cutting this much out of the general fund was way too much. But it's been a bad few weeks for Snyder, and he really needs some sort of win. Let's hope that doesn't come at the expense of our future.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
So that's the real story behind the story. That's Jack Lessenberry's audio commentary that was just posted this morning on michiganradio.org. And so it looks like that's not going to happen. Again, what has Governor Snyder said? Most of the stories there about this indicate that Snyder says that was a story from late yesterday, that the funding plan is positive but needs extensive analysis, quote unquote, by him. What it includes is what he didn't want on the last proposal or package that came to him, which was the $600 million in cuts to basic funding already going on in Michigan from the general fund. And that would be $600 million, not just one time, but every year from now on. Less funding for schools, less funding for social services. That was something he said, we can't do, we must not do. So there's still a chance that even if this does get through the Michigan Senate, where the Democrats are in a higher number, and definitely they won't go for cutting out really essential services, then it probably won't get through the Senate. But if it does get through the Senate, then there's still a chance that Snyder will veto it. But it's a bad plan, right? And, Lessenberry said, a lot of people who voted down the ballot proposal that was pushed on us last spring about how to fix the roads, did include any cuts, but it had so many different ins and outs and adding and subtracting, so confusing, that a patchwork quilt, if you will, that a lot of voters just simply didn't understand it and didn't want that confusion or that complexity. If it was just a user tax on the roads, then people might have gone for it, actually, if it was only that. But, no new taxes, said the Republicans, and especially the Tea Partiers, even though user taxes they've been for in many other situations. They think, many of them used to think, that user taxes, that is taxes paid by people who use the roads or use whatever it is, hunting licenses and so on, that's user taxes. And so that's kind of disingenuous, it's kind of contradictory for those conservative Republicans to not be for user taxes in terms of the highways. Although it's true, good highways benefit all of us because it helps business and industry and so on. And of course, I just wonder, do business pay their fair taxes? I read some criticisms of the plan. They still didn't change the taxation of trucks using the Michigan highways. Many states have a very high tax paid for trucks using our roads and our highways, businesses using our roads and highways, and much higher than Michigan, and we don't do that. And yet it's the heavier weight of those heavier trucks and transports. And I've just been driving on some expressways for the last couple of days out of town where the roads are beautiful. But, if you've driven on interstate highways at all, you know that these trucks are like multi-trailer vehicles. And I don't know how many tires altogether they have, 20, 30 tires altogether from the the driver's compartment, the cab, all the way back. And boy, the road space they take up, I don't know how they manage coming off the expressway or making deliveries around town. I assume they don't do that. There's some warehouse area where they can have a lot of space to turn, and then the loads get transferred to smaller trucks for delivery in a city. But nonetheless, those huge, heavy vehicles actually break up the roads faster. So they should be paying more if you want to talk about user taxes and the fairness that that should be thought about in regard to those taxes. And that's not part of the current plan either. So there's lots of ways you can pick apart or you can talk about this last plan, and everybody would just love to hear a plan getting approved to get these roads starting to be fixed and not just the patchworks fixing that we've seen, which is all like anybody can afford to do right now. And that, that won't last more than a year, and it makes the roads hard to drive on and so on. So anyway, that was Lessenberry's comment on that. And not meaning to go on too long about this, but even though we are a local news show, a lot of people in the United States are not aware that there's a country north of us called Canada. That's no joke. Canadians listening to the show, you know that a lot of Americans don't know too much about geography and even who's across the border. But I've got to say, you've just gone through the longest election period, campaign period up to an election, national election in your history, which was actually chosen by your prime minister, because the prime minister in Canada gets to choose when the elections are going to be, That's interesting, huh? And how long the campaign period is going to be ahead of the election. And this time it was, I think it was almost 6 months, or it was announced 6 months ago. I'm not sure if it was, but anyway, it was the longest, and that seems ridiculous to those of us in the U.S., because in the last couple of presidential campaigns, it seems like the campaigning starts, at least among the Republicans and the Democrats, because that's so noticeable with all their little mini biased debates among themselves. Anyway, it seems to go on for almost 2 years before the election is actually held. And we're in the midst of that right now, some, you know, year and 3 months, 2 months away, 1 month, a year and 1 month, 13 months away, and we're still going strong with Republican and Democratic debates, and the Green Party and Libertarian Party are picking their candidates, and because they're shut out of the Republican and Democrat debates, and shut out so far of the national debates at the end, there's no need, and they have no money, to campaign earlier to get their messages out. But they are out there, at least those two parties I mentioned, and other parties too. In Canada, three main parties shared the lion's share of the votes. And here's, again, Jack Lessenberry from 2 days ago, from Wednesday the 21st, talking about how we should pay attention to Canada's election. And then we'll go on to local stories.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. Someone once said that Americans, including those who live in Michigan, would do anything for Canada except pay attention to it. That was evident again this week. This nation's closest ally had a dramatic national election that most lower Americans probably didn't even know was happening, but which may be highly significant for all of us. Prime Minister Stephen Harper, the most politically conservative Canadian leader in modern times, had been in office for 9 years and was trying for an unprecedented fourth term. Earlier this month, some polls showed his Conservative Party in the lead. Most experts predicted a very close election, which might end up a dead heat between Harper's Conservatives, the Socialist New Democratic Party, and the Liberals, with no party having anything like a majority in Parliament. But that's not what happened. Instead, the Liberals won a stunning landslide Monday, easily winning a solid majority in Canada's Parliament. They more than doubled their share of the popular vote and won almost six times the number of seats they had just 4 years ago. Canada's new Prime Minister is a young man with a famous name, Justin Trudeau, son of the legendary Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Though Pierre Trudeau is often compared to the Kennedys, his young and handsome son more clearly evokes John F. Kennedy. Like JFK, Trudeau takes office at the age of 43, has a beautiful and charismatic wife, and small children. Canada's never gone in for political dynasties, and the Canadian willingness to elect someone with a famous political name may inspire fans of Hillary Clinton. While Canada and the United States have many things in common, they're also very different. Even the most conservative Canadians wouldn't dream of opposing national health care. But there are things about this election that should worry the right wing in this country. Harper was certainly his nation's most socially conservative prime minister in modern times. Harper, who got along better with President George W. Bush than Barack Obama, is a climate change skeptic. He pushed a bill called Canada's Patriot Act. He refused to support efforts to investigate violence against Native American women, and in an act of astonishing cultural chauvinism, tried to ban Islamic women from wearing a veil when becoming citizens. Those policies were decisively rejected by Canadian voters this week. Nearly 60% of them voted for either Trudeau's Liberals or the even further left NDP. During the campaign, Trudeau left absolutely no doubt about where he stood. He's firmly pro-choice and opposes any government effort to limit abortion rights. He plans to move to legalize recreational marijuana immediately. He believes climate change is a huge problem and promised a new national policy. Trudeau plans to end Canada's participation in bombing ISIS, to liberalize immigration policies, and accept 25,000 Syrian refugees by the end of the year. Perhaps most significantly, he said his first move would be to raise taxes on the 1% to support tax cuts for the middle class. Essentially, Justin Trudeau opposes everything the American Tea Party stands for. Knowing this, the voters of Canada elected him in a landslide. Our two nations are indeed different. But politicians in this country might want to think about all that.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
And that's why I think it's so exciting to see what our friends up north, after 10 years of extreme conservative leadership, did. And I can say, well, of course, George W. Bush over here was, extreme conservative, to my mind anyway, not as far as Tea Partiers would say he was. But Barack Obama was elected 7 years ago with a pretty liberal agenda, a lot of which he has not followed through with, which is why these issues are coming up again and being certainly championed very strongly by Bernie Sanders. And Hillary, I think you know her last name, has moved in that direction now because of the strong arguments that have great popular support from coming from Bernie Sanders. So we'll see how that affects the campaign here in the U.S., see what it might mean about political polling, because a lot of the political polls in Canada were pretty much off. A lot of the estimates were quite wrong until the last couple of days, when it was clear that Justin Trudeau was going to, and the Liberal Party in Canada was going to, do very, very well. No one expected them to do quite as well. A couple of polls at the, like a day or two before, suggested that they would have the popular vote 40%, but because of gerrymandering now, again, it doesn't matter the vote total. It depends how many of the districts, they're called ridings in Canada, you know, we call them legislative districts, elective districts, like Michigan, I think we're in the 16th district or 17th here in Dearborn, or they're kind of split up, of course. So it's the gerrymandering, if they have a gerry up in Canada, that the term can be used. It's the redrawing of the district lines, or the lines, the borders of the ridings in Canada, that actually give 40% a majority of the seats in their parliament, you know, their version of Congress. And, of course, there's another almost 20% of the popular votes that went to the even more liberal, more progressive New Democratic Party, or NDP, in Canada, who are going to be supporting, of course, an awful lot of the agendas of Justin Trudeau and the Liberal Party. They'd like to see even a little bit more progressive or more liberal directions, but just to change directions. Climate change is real and verifiable. We got to do something about it. Marijuana, its time has come, I think. I don't need it personally, but, you know, the experiments in the other states seem to have been a pretty good thing, and it seems like things are moving along pretty well. So this is all very, very possible that something might happen with that. Okay, I can't resist Jack Lessenberry. One more comment here from him.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. Governor Rick Snyder yesterday unveiled his new plan to fix Detroit public schools. Actually, it's a variation on one he put forth in April. Like that plan, it seems heavily based on the model General Motors adopted to emerge from bankruptcy. The schools would be divided into a new district and an old one. The old district wouldn't have anything to do with the kids, but would be saddled with paying down the district's massive debts, now over $500 million. The new district would be run by a Detroit Education Commission and would be in charge of educating the students. Educating, that is, not only the 40,000 or so left in the traditional public schools, but thousands more in city charters and the infamous Education Achievement Authority. The plan depends on the conservative Republicans in the legislature agreeing to appropriate hundreds of millions for Detroit public schools. The figure used was $715 million, but my guess is it would be closer to $1 billion. It relies on diverting $70 million a year from the state school aid fund for a decade, and also on another $200 million, largely for what one official called startup costs. Now, you don't have to be the world's greatest political analyst to doubt that the legislature will go for this. Snyder hasn't been able to get his fellow Republicans to agree to appropriate new money to fix the roads. To think they'll agree to divert hundreds of millions to Detroit schools seems a big leap of faith. Most Republicans aren't from Detroit. They seldom go to Detroit. They don't get any votes from Detroit. They don't look like people in Detroit and largely regard it as a corrupt and alien landscape. The governor presumably knows all that, but thinks he can sell his plan on the basis of common sense. He indicated that if the state doesn't do this, Detroit public schools could default on their debts early next year. If the schools enter bankruptcy, the state would have to cover all their debts and retiree pension obligations, and that would mean billions. I believe the governor's right about that. He's a skilled numbers man, but he's presuming rational behavior on the part of the lawmakers. And he's forgetting that the same is true for the roads. The longer you wait to fix them, the more expensive the fix becomes. If that doesn't seem to matter to the legislature, it's hard for me to believe they'll be more eager to help Detroit schools. There's no doubt the state is at least partly responsible for this mess by allowing an explosion of dubious charter schools who drained revenue from the system. But the best and most eloquent commentary on this came from Detroit Free Press's Rochelle Riley this morning. As she observed, this is another plan by and for and against competing groups of bureaucrats and politicians. It doesn't have anything to do with the mission of the schools, namely educating children. In this case, educating children, often from disadvantaged backgrounds, where education is often not a priority. Riley concludes her column by saying, "Let's start screaming. Somebody create a plan for children, not grown-ups." Frankly, I couldn't agree more.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
That's another issue. That proposal to fix Detroit schools seems to be an interesting plan, although I know that many educators are against the idea of the sort of two systems, two different kinds of funding vehicles. And of course, everybody's skeptical because the emergency financial managers were on our fourth or fifth one from the state. So the state has been totally controlling the schools and is deeper in debt now in Detroit than ever. So yeah, this is a new plan, at least. It's a different plan than anything they've tried before. But again, they may not get it through Lansing. Why? Because it means that the state budget has to pony up hundreds of millions of dollars to throw into the Detroit system in order to cover the debts and get things back on a level playing field. And again, those who were elected to government, who believe that government should run with no money at all for anything, they won't vote for it. And that's the way that looks too, even though I think the plan is a little more rational and balanced than the road plan, even though a lot of people think, well, what the heck, just fix those roads, or just willing to give up on it. So, oh well, that's that issue. So I'm glad we caught up on that one. Also here, though, in the studio, another live guest, imagine two in one day, is our friend Steve Soviak, who is the current president of the Detroit Blues Society. That's right, a music guest here on the new WHFR Journal.
How are you doing, Jay?
Well, it's very exciting. I think your microphone is on now. So.
Okay, how are you doing,
Jay? Well, I think we're doing pretty well, except for that microphone issue.
You have
always got a lot of things going on, a lot of different events. Folks, if you're interested in local music performances by really great local artists who you may never have heard the name of before, but it's not their fault. Again, it's DetroitBluesSociety.org, which is their website. But almost every weekend, of course, Joanne Korczynska on her blues show, Highway 61, starting at 2 o'clock today, going to 6, usually about 4:30 or so each day, she does a calendar of all the local blues performances locally within the Detroit metro area for about the next 6 days. And there's always a lot going on. And, of course, the Blues Society is responsible almost every week with a lot of that live performance too, directly yourself. Tell us what's happening. I think it's this Sunday.
Well, this Sunday is the finals of the 2015 Detroit Blues Society Blues Challenge. Mm-hmm. We've got seven bands competing in the Electric Challenge. Performances by the winner of the Solo Duo Challenge, which was held, the finals were held 2 weeks ago at Booze Nightclub in Royal Oak. And then we have a performance from the Youth Challenge winners, which is Leah and the Troublemakers. And that competition was held in August. And both the solo duo, the Youth winner, and the Electric Band winner get to go to Memphis to compete at the International Blues Challenge and represent Detroit at that event, and that's at the end of January next year.
These competitions have been going on for at least a half dozen years, maybe a dozen years now.
Yeah, probably closer to 15, actually.
And I think the categories have expanded, too.
That is correct.
That have been allowed. Like the Youth Challenge is relatively new, right?
3 years old, I believe, yeah.
Right. And yet, just shows that we've got these great this great talent here, and even young people that are choosing the blues genre to at least begin their careers with, if not continue on. And of course, since it is a competition, you get some really spirited performances by quite a few groups. So where is it going to happen and what time?
It'll be Sunday at Callahan's Music Hall in Auburn Hills.
Okay.
Normally where we have the finals at, and it starts at 2 o'clock. And at 2 o'clock, like I said, the winner of the solo duo, his name is John Latini. John Latini will perform starting at 2. He's won the challenge once before and been to Memphis about 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a great way to kick it off.
Yep. And then right after that, be a performance from Leah and the Troublemakers, the Youth Challenge winner. And at 3 o'clock, we'll start the electric competition with 7 bands from all around Southeast Michigan. The Detroit Blues Society has expanded their geographic territory this past year to include Port Huron, Flint, Saginaw, Ann Arbor, and Monroe area. In Dundee, Michigan, is a bar called Thirsty's Pub. They're the place where we had our challenge this year over there, and bands from Ann Arbor, Ipsy, Monroe, and Toledo came to compete in that.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
And the band who won, Bubba and the Powerhouse, Bubba Wilson's Powerhouse, that's what it's called.
Mm.
He's 21 years old. He's been coming to that jam since he was 12.
Wow.
And he writes his own material, he sings, and he plays guitar, and I told him, he's the band to beat this year, I think.
Well, that sounds very exciting. Is there going to be is this the last competition?
Or this will be the
last
finals,
one, the finals.
Correct.
Right, okay.
And then we'll
have
a couple fundraisers.
Yeah, the electrified instrument is the main competition. That could go on till, just so people know, it starts at 2 o'clock, but it could go on to what, 9, 10?
Well, I would think that we'd be out of there by 9.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to limit it to 20-minute sets instead of 30-minute sets because we have so many bands. And, you know, who knows what could go wrong in between setting up bands and stuff. You know, anything could happen.
And you've got always a pretty good group of very knowledgeable judges, either musicians themselves or...
This year we have, there's no exception to that rule. We've got the president of the West Michigan Blues Society, a friend of mine, Felix Yabara, and his wife are coming in to be judges from West Michigan. The president of the Black Swamp Blues Society in Toledo, Cheryl Christie, will be a judge. WHFR's very own Joanne Korczynska will be a judge.
Name dropping.
And Nikki James will be a judge this year. Right. I didn't realize it, but I stacked that deck with women.
They're in the majority, it looks like. That's good. That's good. We get full representation and points of view there.
Yep, that's correct.
Because the guys always speak so loud, you know.
Well, I mean, and that is a pretty good cross-section of blues knowledge.
In terms of, different backgrounds
and so on. Nikki
James
got a new album coming out.
Yes,
and
she does.
She hasn't been on the road in 10 years, so, you know.
Well, again, Steve, of the Detroit Blues Society, thanks for giving us the word about the Blues Challenge, going to be happening this Sunday at Callahan starting at 2 p.m. And the cover charge
is $10, and every single penny goes to the winning band for help finance their trip to Memphis.
That's really, really worth it, folks, and it's a great thing for these artists to get that exposure. There's a lot of media coverage of the Memphis event, which goes on several days, of course.
Yeah, 4 days.
4 days. And so it's really a worthwhile thing. Just one of the many things Detroit Blues Society does. Please check out DetroitBluesSociety.org, and I'm sure Joanne will be talking about and maybe even playing some of the music related to some of the people that have been performing, although some of them are of course, their first time ever in the challenge.
That is correct.
That's the whole idea of it, too.
That is correct.
Get that new talent out there.
Keep right? doing it till you get it right. That's well, right.
Thanks so much, Steve, for giving us the
Thank
word
you, Jay.
About
Appreciate
that.
The
and
time.
I'm going to go back to all the other stories here that I haven't yet covered. They always said with the New York Times, all the news that fits to print, and in my case, it's all the news that I can speak out loud before the clock chimes 2 o'clock. If you're listening on the web to our podcast, again, always available each show. If you want to re-listen to it, if you, what was that phone number again? You just go to our website, whfr.fm, and click on Talk Shows and click on WHFR Journal and select the date. Today is October 23rd, and you can listen to it all over again. Okay. Coming up here. Oh, I mentioned about climate change. In yesterday's New York Times, it's quite official. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced Wednesday that last month had been the hottest September on record since 1880 when tracking began, and 2015, therefore, is likely to set the record for heat for an entire year the way it's going so far, because since January, this has been the hottest temperatures on record month to month since 1880. And there is going to be a global climate conference in December, which Justin Trudeau, as well as we hope significant dignitaries like President Obama, will be attending also. And hopefully they're going to come to the scientific consensus that there's a problem, and it's hitting us now, and it's going to be so much worse in the future if we don't start straightening things out. That is the human emissions of greenhouse gases, primarily. Jessica Blunden, who's a climate scientist with the NOAA, said the bottom line is that the world is warming, and that, of course, means in about 50 years, a lot of low-lying areas at sea level around the coast are going to have real problems. Miami, we're talking about, as well as New York City, New Orleans, just will not be possible to build the walls, the barriers, high enough to keep the water out in 50 years. A lot of people, and worldwide, I mean, it's going to be worldwide, so a lot of people are going to be having to leave their homes. Okay, but moving on to other things here. Let's see what I've got. A lot of things happening. Of course, we're approaching the holiday season. A lot of things happening in the area in terms of holidays, too. I mentioned that, I have to mention this. Tomorrow here at WHFR, we are sponsoring right here in the main campus of Henry Ford College on Evergreen Road from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. our 8th annual record show. That's right. 8 years of people buying vinyl record albums. Yes, they do exist. And more popular than ever, at least in the last 5 years, anyway. They keep growing in significance. People want to buy that vinyl and get a turntable and play the music that way. Ooh, pretty wild. People tell me, and I can tell you, that vinyl does sound in many ways preferable to listening to CDs. It all depends, of course, on the mix of the music and how good your ears are to hear the difference. But it's just becoming a very special collector sort of thing, and it's moving out into a large audience. And so we will have some of the best vendors in the region here tomorrow in our Student Center building, right next to the WHFR studios, in fact, in that building. And it'll be from 10 to 4. And from 10 to 4, admission is $1 or more. And all the donations just go to WHFR because we can't survive without that. We do want to thank the Dearborn Times Herald and the Dearborn Press and Guide for getting the word out about our record show. Our story is in both of the papers this week. And there's also used CDs, there's music memorabilia, there's all kinds of fun things. And WHFR will be there selling our used CD collection, which is only $1 a CD. That's the lowest prices of anyone there. And a lot of unique stuff that no vendors have because it's only sent to record stations. I've also want to tell you that in upcoming shows, we've got a special interview scheduled with Superintendent Glenn Malico, who is the new superintendent of Dearborn Public Schools. And that's going to be on November 13th. Yep, another great Friday the 13th, and he is going to give us 30 minutes of his time for a fast-paced number of questions, like the future of the DPS Administrative Center. Looks like, at this point, from the stories this week in the Times-Herald and the Press and Guide, that the Dearborn Public Schools Board of Education is pretty much, they have to wait till November meeting to make it official, but they're going to spend whatever it takes, $10 million or more, to fix the roof on the Dearborn Administrative Center and some other things. They're in bad shape there. You know, there was discussion that they might just, well, move out of the building and instead of spending $10 million, move into the Dearborn Administrative Center, where the Dearborn City government offices are located. That was something that Mayor O'Reilly was thinking about a couple years ago, because they got a lot of open space on the second floor of that building. And it looks like, for whatever reasons, and I'd like to know what the thought is there, that they want to spend the money to fix the Tenaik Center and not to join with the city government in the same building. Not that they'd be joining city government in any technical, legal way, of course. So anyway, that special interview with Glenn Malico, Superintendent of Dearborn Public School, is going to be here. Of course, stories also say, yes, he's accomplishing his goals that he set for himself for the first 100 days. And again, if you don't know his name, he's been with the district since he was a teacher here. So he's one of the first superintendents that I know of that has background in all the areas, administration as well as teaching, and now he's superintendent. So he's got a lot of agenda items, and we'll be talking about more of those with him. A couple of things got into the paper this week. For example, he wants the administrators to put their electronic devices away during meetings and to be more attentive. So when he's given a meeting, he doesn't want any distractions there. You're not supposed to follow your phone. He's even challenged the school board, the Board of Ed, to not have their devices out. And a couple of the Board of Ed members said, definitely not. I have a life other than this job. And one said, I'm a mother. I've got four kids. I'm going to keep that phone right on my desk there. So any call comes in, I'm going to take it. Yes, sirree, Bob. We must stay connected every second, because otherwise the world will fall apart. But I think out of respect for the new superintendent, and they say, well, you know, some of these school board meetings, they go 4 to 5 hours. So we got to keep in touch with what's going on elsewhere. Well, maybe if they weren't looking at their devices so much and they were paying more attention, they'd get things done a little faster. I'm just saying. Okay. The last Dearborn City Council meeting, I actually did go to that. I'm not sure I want to go to another one, but it only was an hour and 20 minutes. So I didn't see any of them looking at their electronic devices. They were looking at the big video screens to see what their image looked like. You know, they love playing to the cameras, but they weren't looking at their little personal electronic tablets or whatever. And things went very, very quick, quicker than I could even figure out what was going on. So anyway, let's see here, looking through some other things. I know tonight is the big, very expensive, but very important fundraising at the Dearborn Inn for the Dearborn Animal Shelter. I'm sure if you had like $150 a person and you showed up in a nice outfit, you know, doesn't have to be a tuxedo, they'd still let you in because they're trying to make money for all the animals. It's interesting how almost all of our local politicians show up for that Black Tie and Tails event, as it's called, Dearborn Animal Shelter. The Friends of the Dearborn Animal Shelter that sponsor that, and it's a great event, and it's something that all politicians, apparently, Democrats or Republicans, can come together on, and that is at least attending the event. I'm not sure they're all supporting animals in any other way, but anyway. Okay, a lot of new businesses opening in Dearborn this fall, and I don't want to do a commercial for any one of them, but check out West Dearborn and East Dearborn. There's a lot of new businesses, and they're talked about in several stories in the Press and Guide and the Times-Herald. John Conroy, who is not here today, our WHR news director, he has tried a few of them, and he was saying They're all very good. One he said was a little pricey, and he'll be back next Friday to maybe fill us in on his restaurant reviews. Okay. Dearborn Historical Museum, again, always trying to raise money for themselves. They got a lot of events. This one is going to be October 30th. That is next Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. The cost is only $2 a child. The kids should be dressed in Hollywood attire as part of the best costume contest. And people say it's going to be a scarily good time by the Dearborn Historical Society. And that party includes prizes, games, and treats at the museum's McFadden Ross House, Brady Street, north of Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn. For more information, you can just call the Dearborn Historical Museum, of course. Next Friday, October 30th, from 4 to 6 p.m. Okay, moving right along. Oh, my goodness. 2 minutes before 2 o'clock. It's WHFR Dearborn you're listening to. This is the new WHFR Journal. Jay Koronek with you for this whole hour. Always fun, always a lot going on. You definitely should subscribe, you know, to your Press and Guide and Time or and Times Herald and read this for yourself in great detail. A real tragedy, at least for some people, like veterans of foreign wars. The post in Dearborn, which is the state's oldest post, 101 years old in August, they're behind in their gas and electricity bills for about $10,000 since thieves broke into the post stealing donations, cash, and liquor last year. I didn't hear about that. That's awful. And this is important work that they do for our so many veterans of foreign wars, not just from World War One or Two, but all the wars that are still going on when people come back. The VFW is an important, doing an important service. And they're going to be kicked out of there. They'll have to close down if they can't get help. So they're asking for all kinds of help. Maybe you can write a check. They don't have a big gala anywhere that I see. $1,690 been raised by 38 people since a special account, a GoFundMe account, GoFundMe.com, I believe that is, on the internet. Any help you can give them would be greatly appreciated. Otherwise, they just can't continue. Veterans of foreign wars. That's just wrong. It's wrong that somebody stole their stuff a year ago. That's really wrong. Somebody, like, I don't know, city government can't help? Okay, maybe not. Oh, and then Christopher Columbus statue is vandalized. Okay, he didn't really discover America. And somebody threw red paint on him. This is Oakman Boulevard, just north of Michigan Avenue, vandalized with red paint. Is that because only the so-called Redskins who were here, they were the true Americans? I think it was a Native American protest? Nobody knows. But that happened back on October 12th, and it's just unfortunate. I mean, he was a great explorer. Okay, he was a Western European, but come on. He didn't really himself enslave or exploit anybody.